At the Society of Wireless Pioneers Convention, I have Lee Fassett, whose first ship was the SS Oleum, an oil tanker, on which he was a radio operator as far back as 1913. Is that right, Mr. Fassett?
That is right.
About how old were you at that time? How old are you now?
I'm 80 years old now. That's going back quite a way. So it must have been...
You were a young...
17 or 18.
You were a young feller.
Yeah, just out of high school.
How did you happen to get into the wireless business at that early age?
Well, first off, to get into this radio and wireless was developed by the radio amateurs at that time. And as a result, through our experience as wireless amateurs, we naturally decided that sooner or later we wanted to be commercial operators on the ships. And that was our ambition at that time, I can assure you.
You say you were a ham.
Well, that's what we call them now, hams, at that time.
Explain what that means.
Well, just amateur wireless operators. How
old were you and started doing that?
Well, I probably was around 15 years of age.
Uh-huh. Did you build your own receiving
sets? Oh, we always built our receiving sets. And, of course, we used tuning coils or loose couplers and crystal detectors.
Now, where was this? Where did you live at this time?
San Francisco.
And did you take a training course in order to become a ship's operator?
No.
How did you learn the code?
Well, we learned that because that's all we used at the time was code to talk to one another from one amateur to the other. There was no telephones in that time, radio telephones. So naturally, the only thing was to use the Continental code.
How'd you get your first job on this oil tanker?
Well, it was through the United Wireless Telephone or Telegraph Company. And first, it was necessary to get a commercial license to operate aboard ship. And as a result, with the experience that we obtained in our amateur work, we naturally started to get the commercial aspect of it. And we gradually got enough information to get our commercial license.
Now, Lee DeForest hadn't yet perfected the radio tube. How did these radio transmitters operate in those days?
Well, the transmitters at that time were developed by a transformer of usually a quarter kilowatt or a half kilowatt or 1 kilowatt. And then you had the helix, as they called it, for tuning it, and the spot gap, which made a considerable noise. And as time went on, they developed the rotary gap, which gave a higher frequency in our transmitted signal.
Now, many ships probably used this in the early days, but was it slow in coming?
Well, they were using it, only they didn't use the rotary gaps until later. But the shipboard was just a straight spark inside of the helix with a gap of about half an inch.
I mean, the whole idea of using wireless aboard a ship, this didn't become practical until about 1901, let's say, when Marconi perfected it. You were using this in 1913. Were many other ships using it?
There was quite a few ships at that time, yes, because it was beginning to become prevalent with the steamship operators to put them aboard ship as a safety precaution.
How many years did you work as a ship's operator?
Well, I worked about 4 years as a wireless operator aboard ship in the commercial capacity, and then later I went over to the was called at that time the Naval Auxiliary Service, that was the what they call today the train to the main fleet. And in those days, the ships were manned by just the civilian crews.
Were you on board any of the ships during World War One?
Oh, I was, yes. I was in the Navy at that time.
Were you in the combat zones?
Well, I made 10 round trips across that Atlantic, and I surely was in going over to the island, British Isles,
Do you ever have occasion to hear a distress signal?
I never did in all my experience, really.
Is that a fact?
That's a fact.
What kind of messages would be transmitted then?
Well, you're speaking of...
Yes, right.
Commercial?
No, between ships.
Well, usually, not between ships so much as it was between land stations and the ships, giving, like, on a tanker, the usual was to get a message of change orders for your destination, or always to give around 8 o'clock at night, or as close as you could, the weather conditions in your proximity of the vessel.
So that was really important, wasn't it, to get
the
weather conditions?
Well, that was how they kept posted on weather conditions up and down the coast, and even out at sea.
Now, I live in San Anselmo these days.
That's right.
And you're retired and enjoying life, Bruce.
I surely am.
In Marin County.
Oh, yes. I retired in 63 and still having the balls.
You have with me Bill Brenneman, who is Vice President and General Manager of the Society. Bill, how long has this group been in existence?
We started in 1967, actually. And the first full luncheon meeting we had was here in San Mateo in February of 1968. And we've had luncheons here ever since, and it's been very well attended. This time we had well over 100.
What does it mean, a wireless pioneer? What do you have to have by way of qualifications?
The criteria for belonging to the society is that you have had to be a professional wireless or radio operator, that you have handled a circuit, been assigned to a ship or station sometime during your working life for which you received remuneration of one kind or another, not necessarily commercial, but it could be government, or it could be quasi-government, or most any of the independent services.
How many members do you have these days?
We have going on 2,000 right at the moment. The present account right out today, as you asked me, is 1,953.
Now, do you have any idea of the oldest member, that is someone who was a wireless operator way, way back?
Well, we have quite a number of, we call them spark gap pioneers, the members who pounded brass, that's the expression we use in our lingo. Back in, probably our oldest member would date back about 1906 or 1907, and I would guess offhand without going through our statistics that we probably have in the general area of 50 of those who pounded brass before 1915.
Well, this is almost going back to the very beginning of wireless then, isn't it?
Yes. Matter of fact, some of our members were assigned to Navy ships, particularly. If I recall correctly, I think we have one member who has since passed on that was with the first Navy ship that had a wireless transmitter and the receiving equipment put aboard. And I think that was about 1901. Now, we have any number of them that were on ships from 1907 and on out.
How did this organization get started? I understand you were a spark plug. How did you get the idea for it, if you did?
Well, thanks for the compliment. I was the founder of it. It was a kind of a brainchild of mine. You asked me how it got started. Well, as an old brass pounder who went to sea before World War I, I have many, many friends around the Bay Area here. And when we moved here from Southern California, and more importantly, I've been all over the United States, but our last assignment for the Civil Aeronautics Administration was in Los Angeles, where I was Chief of Technical Service and Planning. When I retired, I came up to Santa Barbara, and we lived there for a while. And then we liked the green country, and we wanted to get back among old friends. And some of these old-timers that I had known 50 years ago lived around here, so I called them, and we used to have little get-togethers, and it grew. Each year, we'd have probably double our number. So after a while, I got to thinking, well, it's got so large now, why not just start an organization of them? And this thing has mushroomed beyond all proportion. We never thought that we would have anything like this at all. The idea, of course, is that both fraternal. We like the fellows to get together. It gives them an avenue to our means of meeting one another. It also, we had in mind preserving for posterity the records of old-time radio men so that they wouldn't be lost, because there's been a lot of history made, and we think it's very important because wireless, after all, preceded the television and preceded radio as such, and most of the men who were identified with television and early day radio came from the ranks of the wireless men, because they were the only ones at that time that knew much about the technical end of it, and as a result of it, many of them became announcers, and maybe many of them became station owners, and many, many technicians out of the group.
And how early were you a wireless operator?
If you're talking about amateur, the Titanic, the ship, the sinking of the Titanic kind of sparked off a little something in my makeup that intrigued me. So I decided to be a wireless operator, and I bought some amateur equipment, as most of those fellows did in those days, but I didn't become a commercial operator, or rather, I didn't become an operator, per se, until World War I, when I joined the Navy and did go to sea on Navy ships and learned the code, at least learned to operate equipment at that time aboard ship. After I got out of the Navy, where I had many years of commercial experience, and later on went into the, what is now the FAA, we used to call it the Bureau of Lighthouses Aeronautical Branch. I became the deputy director of their service in Washington, and I've had many posts. My life has been a very enjoyable one, and it's all been connected with communications.
Where's your ear? Can you still understand it?
I can take about anything they can throw at me. Yet, once you learn it, I don't think you ever forget it.
Now, something that puzzles me is the fact that we still have wireless. That is, and we're using the code. Why is that? If people could talk to each other, we have the voice apparatus that works now.
Well, of course, the perfection of voice and the channels that they can use now is such that some think that code is becoming kind of outdated. But it has been proven many, many times that on ships, for example, that when they get into real tight spots, that the only way you can really get the signals through, get the information about SOS calls or distress calls through, is by wireless, by the code.
Someone told me that it's an international language because if a Frenchman is talking and you don't know French, why, voice is no good. But if he's using the code, there are certain expressions like SOS that everybody understands. Is that one of the reasons?
That is one of them, and that is a good reason. We have a group of signals. We call them the Q signals, like they're an international group of signals that all wireless men know, whether they're American, whether they're British, whether they're French or Japanese or what have you. And if you ask, tell a man, ask him QTC, for example, you know he's asking for your location. Or if you ask him, tell him QRL, you tell him that you're busy at the moment. Or there's all of these, there's probably 100 of them all together that every man in the world that's connected to the fraternity knows, and it is an international type of language, so we know what we're telling them. And as you say, if you were to use voice, we probably couldn't understand them. Sometimes we can't understand our own people.
What does CQ mean?
CQ means a general call. It means I'm calling for a contact.
Now, is there a sign-off for a signal or a code?
Well, we call it AR. It's when you're over with the entire transmission, we say 30, which means final.
Okay, this is Gordon Grebs saying AR from the Society of Wireless Pioneers in San Mateo. Wireless pioneers have come to California for a get-together from all over the United States. But one man who didn't have to go too far is with me now, Foreign Mays of Saratoga, California. We're at his home now, and in his den, where along one wall we have a tremendous collection of books of radio and wireless magazines, encyclopedias, directories, you name it. And along another wall of the grandest and most colorful collection of gadgets I've ever seen in my life. Thorne, tell me, what in the world is all of this that you've collected? Where did you get it? How long have you had it? And why do you have it?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. But it represents a collection of equipment that was used by the wireless industry. It's practically all commercial, very little amateur equipment. Was used during the Spark era, which was before the advent of vacuum tubes, in the period prior to World War I. The historical record of the equipments that were used back in those days is not too complete, and there are many collectors in this country in the last 20 years who have been trying to fill out pieces of equipment to illustrate the type of gear that was used back in those early days of spark communication before the broadcasting started. As to where these equipments come from, you pick them up wherever you can find them. Most of it, of course, went to the junk pile as scrap. But there were people back in those days who saved this equipment, and you find it at flea markets now. You find it in secondhand furniture stores. And you never know when you may run across a piece of this equipment. However, there are some items that are no longer available. And in order to illustrate the type of construction that was used in those days, it's necessary to get a piece from some collector who has been fortunate enough to find it, make drawings of it, and make a replica. This one is a magnetic detector, which was developed by the by Marconi himself in 1904, and it was used as a detector by the British and Canadian Marconi companies from the 1904 period up to close to World War I. This particular one I purchased from an operator in Canada who said that this detector was in operation at their station at Cape Race in 1912. When they were receiving signals from the Titanic.
That's truly amazing. You have a collection then that's priceless. Thorne, you're a writer, you're a historian, you're a consultant to the Foothill Electronics Museum, which is located at the campus of Foothill College. And there, next weekend, the end of April, will be a gathering of wireless pioneers for an entirely different purpose. You belong to the organization that's going to meet this weekend, the Antique Wireless Association. Now, this is something similar to people who collect antique cars, isn't it?
Yes, I was one of the charter members of the Antique Wireless Association. It's made up of around 1,200 members in this country and some in foreign countries who are interested primarily in the collection and documentation of the early history of wireless, principally in the United States.
And the collection of the gadgets and the equipment as well.
Yes, and another important area that's collected is the literature that covered construction and operation of the equipment back in those days. For example, the technical magazines. I have here copies of most of the technical magazines bound that were used or that were issued during that period. There is quite an overlap in the membership of the Wireless Pioneers meeting that you attended last Saturday and the coming meeting of the Antique Wireless Association.
Now, the collection at Foothill College, the Electronics Museum, came from a private party. And if it hadn't been for these private individuals who collected all of these gadgets and tubes and whatnot, the museums would really not have anything to display, would they?
That is true. The collection at Foothill College was made by a Mr. Perham, who was a very ingenious machinist over the years, and he worked for most of the early electronics concerns located between San Jose and San Francisco. For example, he put in a number of years working for the Federal Telegraph Company in the early days. And he was a typical collector, and he asked the companies that he worked for to let him have the models that they made of new designs. And in that way, the Perham collection was made and turned over to the Foothill College Museum.
Now, one of the amazing things about the museum is that it actually has on display Doc Herald's original broadcasting station. How did Perham acquire that? Do you know?
Well, when Dr. Herald, let me go back to the real start of it. Dr. Herald started his experimental work back in 1909 using an induction coil to generate the carrier to transmit the voice. He heard of the work that was being done by Poulsen in Denmark, and sometime along in 1910 or 1911, he developed an arc type of transmitter. In order to get the power that he wanted, he had a set of multiple arcs, and he modulated this radio frequency that the arcs generated by means of microphones. But his problem was that the modulation current was way past the capacity of the normal carbon microphone, so he had to water cool them and put several in parallel. Well, he used this arc transmitter up until the time when the Navy took over the operation of all radio equipment at the start of World War I in 1917. Now, during the war, the vacuum tube was developed into a piece of equipment that would handle appreciable amounts of power. And as you know, along in 1921 and 22, broadcasting started in the United States. At that time, the equivalent of the present FCC set up the frequency, wavelength of 360 meters for the transmission of voice and music. But Harold's original arc transmitter would not operate at this high frequency. He had been operating at about 1,200 meters, which is approximately one-fourth the frequency of the channel now set up for broadcasting. So he had to scrap his arc transmitter and start in from scratch and develop a tube transmitter. Well, the arc transmitter was available at Harold's shop, and Perham saw it and traded him out of it. And that's how Foothill College Museum now has the original arc transmitter used by Harold in his experimental work.
Ray Newby was at the convention of the Society of Wireless Pioneers. Ray says that the station that was put on the air in San Jose is the world's first. Do you agree with him on that?
Well, you have to define your terms here before you say first. For example, Dr. Fessenden in 1906 at his station in Brant Rock, Massachusetts, using a 2-kilowatt, 50-kilocycle alternator, was the first person to transmit speech and music for any great distance. And there, on Christmas Eve, 1906, he transmitted a program that was heard as far south as Norfolk, Virginia. However, this was not a regular, recurring transmission at all. It was purely experimental work. Professor Harold, on the other hand, to my knowledge, was the first one who printed programs of what he was going to broadcast, and this was taking place back as early as 1910 and 11. On the other hand, there are those people in the radio industry that claim that KDKA was the first first broadcast station in the United States, and it is true that they did print programs that were far more complete than Harold's simple page with a list of the phonograph records that he was going to play. But in my opinion, Harold was the first one to do this type of broadcasting.
It's amazing, isn't it, that the people who began this industry are still alive.
Well, we're most fortunate, of course, at this time that there are enough of the old-timers still with us. For example, you will remember at the Wireless Pioneers meeting, there were operators at the meeting who started on shipboard as operators as early as 1910.
I met a man who started in 1908.
That's right. That's right. Well, as I said, we're fortunate that there are still enough of these pioneers left that we can piece together from what they tell us what went on over the period 1900 to 1920. By 1920, most of the small wireless companies that had been formed primarily for stock selling purposes had been combined. And when RCA was formed from the American Marconi Company, from then on, we've had good records of their development work. And it's really the period up to 1920 that still has a lot of dark places because we don't know just what was done by some of these companies. But we're gradually filling in this material.
Thorne, you keep busy at your typewriter putting together articles about the early days. What is it that makes you enthusiastic about doing this kind of work?
Well, I think it's most interesting to dig out the details, going through trade publications and discussions with old-timers, finding out actually how this communication business was carried on back in the period prior to World War I.
And the pioneers aren't going to be around much longer, so it's important to talk to them now and get the record straight. Is that right?
That is so right. They're just going far too rapidly, and we must hurry if we're going to get this material.
This is Gordon Greb, Saratoga, California.